Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kelly, your host. I know we have listeners all over the world, and I don't know if we talked and joked a little bit about the eclipse in the first hour because it did seem like the country went insane for the eclipse. And by the country, I mean the TV networks. I don't know if human beings actually did. And I'm not against eclipses. I'm just saying it was a lot. They did a lot. And eclipse.
I really like things like that.
Do you?
There's something so, it almost feels old-timey about just like, there's a natural phenomenon. There's no scandal. Nobody's getting hurt.
Oh, isn't that nice, Joe? You're a good person.
There's some crazy thunder outside. Let's go. Yeah, partly, like, this is my being Midwestern. Because if two Midwesterners meet after getting excited about the fact that they're both from the Midwest, they will then talk about whatever the weather is. And it doesn't matter if it's good, bad, or indifferent. And they will talk about it for a weirdly long time. And then they'll leave friends.
Oh, see, I don't want to say Midwesterners are the best people in America, but there's nobody better than them.
I appreciate you acknowledging that.
No,
I wasn't going to disagree.
Oh, I know what we are out here. I know exactly what we are out here on the West Coast.
Don't get me in trouble.
No, you meet really nice people in
California.
Oh, you made a comment about Californians? You can do it. I can do it. You can't do it. I can do it because I'm a Californian.
I can't do it.
That's not right.
You're a Bostonian.
Kind of. I'm bicoastal.
You and Whitey Bulger fled to California for undisclosed reasons.
We did it about the same time, too. Oh, and sometime I have to tell you about that.
I've noticed.
I think I saw him one time, but I don't want to talk about that right now. Sometime I'll tell you my Whitey Bulger story.
Not on the air because we need you as a host.
I'm not going to say anything bad about him. I'm not scared of him anymore. I mean, I'll tell you what, if I had run into him, I would have been very respectful. Let me just put it that way. I felt bad. I mean, I felt immediately bad because I said, if you could be quick with your question to Lorraine before we went to the break. And it wasn't a quick question. I misunderstood what was going on. And so especially because I'd be honest with you, Lorraine, it sounded like you might not be one of our fellow Catholics. And I didn't want you to feel like we're just like, we'll give you the 2-second answer and then brush you off. You can have as much time as you want. So did you stay with us, Lorraine?
Yes, I did.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I'm here.
All right. Yep, I got you.
I do belong to the church.
Oh, you're Catholic?
Yes, I am.
Oh, Lorraine, I'm sorry. I just assumed because you were asking about the structure of the church that that maybe you weren't one of us, and I apologize for that.
You know what, Lorraine? We're going to let you do the talking. I think Cy has done plenty.
No, I think I'm doing great, Joe. I think I'm doing great. This actually meets my standards. That's how sad this is. Lorraine?
No, I was talking about the church yesterday. We were talking about it, and I just want to make sure I know what I was talking about.
All right.
You know, get it right.
Yeah, but then...
So I say it's the Pope. Then, you know, the cardinals pick the Pope. And, you know, don't have the Pope when somebody dies. So from there on, it's Pope, cardinals, I guess,
so,
bishops.
Yep. Well, yeah, so cardinals are a little bit of a funny thing because you don't have to be a bishop to be a cardinal. It's a special role in the church. So you have, like, the holy orders, you know, the actual ordained ministries given by Christ, but then there's a lot of other roles that are in the church as well, and these roles aren't like holy orders. Well, cardinal is more like that. It's like one of those kind of roles. In the same way that, you know, you might have a particular ministry at your parish, that doesn't make you an ordained minister. And so cardinal isn't an ordained ministry. It's something that is given to the ordained as a special role that they have in addition. It's for primarily in the event that the Pope dies, but it also carries with it also certain other privileges where it shows that you have kind of the approval and backing of the Pope in a certain sense. And so you have a little authority. Like if you go and you want to go preach in another bishop's diocese, you can. And it's a little more complicated to do that if you're not a cardinal and you're a regular bishop. You've got to double check with that bishop. And without getting too much in the weeds, the most important part of being a cardinal is being able to help elect the next pope. After that, all of the world is divided up into provinces, and these provinces are then subdivided into dioceses. And so within each province, you have one archbishop, and then you have other bishops. So a little bit like states within the country. And so it's a way of keeping things kind of nice and organized, and hopefully have more of an opportunity for the bishop to have a personal relationship with his people. In the United States, we've done this at the city level, and so a lot of dioceses are just massive. You know, there's millions and millions of people in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, for instance. If you go in places like Europe, you'll find that they're much smaller, where, you know, a medium-sized town might have its own bishop. And I think there's something to that, because it lets people have contact with the successor of the apostles at a more intimate kind of level. But either way, the point is that you have a province, and an archbishop and a bishop, they're the same order. Again, remember, in terms of holy orders, but an archbishop is the bishop that's in charge of that province. He's not the boss of the other bishops, but he does help to kind of lead and guide his neighbor bishops. And then beneath that, you have the priests, and beneath that, you have deacons who, as I said before, act in the person of Christ the servant. You know, so if you remember in the Gospel of John, when Jesus washes the feet of the apostles, that service in Greek is called diakonia. And so these are sometimes unmarried, sometimes married men who have this particular ministry of serving the least of these. And then, of course, there's all the rest of us, the lay faithful, and all of the different roles we may have within the church and within the world in bringing the gospel to everyone else.
All right, Lorraine, now, did we get at what you wanted, or did you have a follow-up to that?
Yes, and I've been in the church since 1998.
Oh, praise God.
Wow. Congratulations.
I'm still learning.
Yeah, well, we all are.
You're my younger sister in the faith then, okay. Lorraine.
Oh, yeah, she's younger than me.
I beat you into the church by 13 years.
Yes. I love it.
Oh, praise God. Oh.
Did you come in at Easter time in 98?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, happy anniversary.
Okay, and thank you. And EWTN taught me so much. Mother Angelica taught me so much. Because I had nobody else to teach me.
Man, we hear that so much. Lorraine, thank you very much. And thanks for that testimony to Mother Angelica in particular, because what an extraordinary life and contribution she made. None of us would be here without her. We've got books. If you'd like one, I'll send you one. I was thinking of Why We're Catholic. I like that book a lot, but you can have any of the Catholic Answers books. If you just hang on, Edgar will get your information, and you give him a place to send it, and we'll send you the book, all right?
Okay, and thank both of you guys.
Thank you all. Thanks
Absolutely.
Very much.
Absolutely. God bless you, Lorraine.
Lorraine. All right. Yeah, well, I was thinking while you were talking about bishops, Lorraine's in Chicago. So that's not one of those places where you're like, oh, yeah, it's a nice little place where you get to know the bishop. Yeah. That's not the biggest Catholic diocese in the U.S. I think it's...
No, I believe L.A. is, LA. But it's up there. It's one of the biggest.
Nicholas is in Louisiana. Nicholas, thank you for waiting. Nicholas is watching on YouTube. Thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question, Nicholas.
Thank you. So my question is in regards to the sexual morality within the marital bonds. And so I'm going to try to keep it as PG-13 as possible, so please bear with me.
Bless you.
Yeah, that's a good warning for everyone listening.
Yes, we will be bearing with you. And we also have our finger on a certain button here.
All right, so let's just call it the anticipatory actions for the conjugal act in which a married couple partake in. Wouldn't the utilization of these facilities be contrary to the natural function which these facilities were designed for?
In the service, as you said, anticipatory actions, they can assist in the performance of the marital act. And so they're not an end unto themselves. And so if you treated them as an end unto themselves, then you'd be misusing parts of your body. But, I'm trying to find delicate ways of saying, sometimes, especially the husband may struggle and may need some kind of help to be prepared to engage in the act.
I understand that, and I've actually seen a bunch of theologians who have given me the same answer. I think one of the theologians at Catholic Answers, actually Mr. Tom Nash, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
A response similar to that. And My question was more along the lines of, though it assists and it's not an end in and of itself, wouldn't that means still be considered unnatural?
I have to just interject that this is so abstract, and bless you for being abstract, that it's hard to know exactly which particular acts we might be talking about. And there are forums where we can discuss those particular acts, but do you feel like you have enough information, Joe?
Well, it's actually, you're making a good distinction, because there are some things you wouldn't do even in anticipation of the marital act.
Yeah.
Anything contrary to, like, you wouldn't do anything contrary to human dignity. You wouldn't do anything contrary to the dignity of the body. But for instance, like, the use of one's hands may assist in some various ways, and that's not contrary to the nature of what a hand is or the nature of what any part of the body is, as long as, again, you're not treating it as an end unto itself.
So, like, whenever you make the distinction between, let's say, like, fellatio and sodomy, like, how would you explain that on a natural basis?
Well, that got more specific. Ooh. Yeah.
We moved
from the abstract to the quite specific. Go ahead, Joe. You can if you like.
Yes, because the latter of the two is actually destructive of human dignity in a pretty obvious and direct way, would be what I would suggest at the outset, that it seems more obviously demeaning and degrading. And so that isn't, you will find moralists who argue that it's okay, again, if it's just used as an anticipatory measure. But I think there's a strong case to make that something seems obviously wrong about that. And, if you wouldn't want a person to use, for instance, violence, even if that was something that they found personally helpful, you would just say, too bad, that's so unacceptable. You can't be violent with your partner, your spouse. It doesn't matter if this helps you to engage in the marital act, that's gross and wrong. So we have to draw the line there. So the two boundaries that we're looking at, number one is, are you treating this thing that isn't an end unto itself as an end? That's very clear cut. And number two, even if you're not, is the means that you're using to get to a good end immoral for some reason? For instance, it's contrary to human dignity. And so those are the two things we're looking for. And so it does take more of a prudential judgment on that second question of saying, well, am I treating my wife lovingly? And if I can't say yes with a clear conscience, then that's not acceptable. And there's 1,000 ways that aren't as easy to document that would fall into this, because you can fall into the sin of lust within marriage. And so if you're objectifying your wife, or if you're imagining she's somebody else, those things are wrong in marriage, because you're not treating her with the love and dignity that she deserves. And so for all of those reasons, I think that would be the framework I would assess any of the kind of particular questions, regardless of just the teleological stuff of what is the nature of the body made for. You also have the personalist stuff of, are you treating the other person as made in the image of God?
We did a quite explicit couple of programs about this with Father Hugh Barber a few years ago, who is a very, very good moralist, as a matter of fact, very, very helpful and willing to be somewhat unrestrained in his in the specificity of his comments. So I don't know how to get those, though, Darren. Do you remember the name of them? Or maybe we'll take the break.
I don't know what to Google there.
Yeah, be careful what you Google, right? But I'll tell you what, Nicholas, we'll take a break, because other people, I know that there are other people that are interested in this, and to have a priest, a theologian of the caliber of Father Hugh Barber, speak explicitly about what's acceptable in marriage and what is not is actually, I thought it was a great service. So we'll get I'll get you the name of the episode. It might have been two episodes that we did a few years ago, and make those, and I'll just say what they are when we come back. We got to take quick break, right back with more Open Forum with Joe Heschmeyer and Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live. Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
This is Jim Pinto, director of EWTN Media Missionaries. EWTN's mission is to spread the eternal word and to teach others that Jesus Christ is the way, the truth, and the life. You can help EWTN share the good news by becoming a media missionary. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today and join us in sharing the eternal word with the world.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Well, now the eclipse is not the most exciting thing that happened to me today. The episode that we was with Father Hugh Barber is called Sex After Marriage. It aired on April 23rd, 2018. Spring is in the air. That's why these questions come up. So spring is in the air. So I would say look up Father Hugh, Catholic Answers, Sex After Marriage, and you'll find it. Your machine will find it. It is a very good episode, one that I was quite happy with when it was done. And it's detailed and specific and very well-reasoned. So, and these are very good and important questions. So, Nicholas, I hope that helps. I'm going to Montreal, Canada. Where I don't even think they got an eclipse today. Did the Canadians even get an eclipse? Would they get like some kind of remnant, some leftover of the American eclipse? Because on the American media, they literally called it, I saw this on TV today, the Great American Eclipse. I feel like, wow.
No.
We own the eclipse now? But then I
think one American eclipse is worth like 1.36 Canadian eclipses.
I think that's exactly right. I didn't like that Americanism, but then suddenly I just warmed up to it. I was like, yeah, it is our eclipse. Sorry, Canada. Oh, hello, Charles.
Hi there.
Hey. Did you guys?
I saw the eclipse in Montreal. It was full.
Oh, you had the full eclipse in Montreal?
Oh, wow. You got to tell me.
Wow.
You should have been the 51st state.
And how do you should have. And how do you say eclipse in French?
Eclipse.
Ah, I love French. What a great language. I never would have guessed that.
What will they think of next?
Those French always coming up with a clever turn of phrase.
Yeah, very original.
Yeah. Charles, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Yes, my question is... about suicide. Suicide is usually a mortal sin, but in certain circumstances, it can be a venial sin. So I'd like to have clarity over that.
Okay.
Yeah. So for something to be a mortal sin, like a deadly sin, to cut you off from the life of grace and to cut you off from the life of God in a real way, three things are necessary. The action itself has to be serious. This is what we call grave matter. And you have to do it freely, and you have to do it knowingly. And those are tricky to evaluate, both in yourself and basically impossible to evaluate in another person. Because you don't always know how much you consented to a certain action and how much, you know, various factors kind of play into that. But we can see these principles laid out in the Bible. For instance, when Jesus is on the cross, what does he say? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. He's not saying right. What they did wasn't bad. It was the worst sin in human history. But he is nevertheless right. Pleading for them for a lack of knowledge in some way. Now, I think you or I would look at that and say, they don't seem that ignorant. These are, in some cases, the teachers of the law. These are the teachers of Israel. And yet, God sees an ignorance in their heart, and he has pity on them, and he has mercy on them. And he prays for them, which is really tremendously beautiful. And of course, also, you know, for the Roman soldiers who are obviously much more ignorant. And we see it bear fruit in you know, the soldier who cries out, truly, this was the Son of God. So in the case of suicide, you have a very serious action. You have grave matter. But there are two levels where either knowledge or the freedom to not do it can be impinged. And the Catechism talks about this very clearly in paragraph 2282. It says, grave psychological disturbances, anguish, or grave fear of hardship, suffering, or torture can diminish the responsibility of one committing suicide. So that gives you, not an exhaustive list, but a list of the kind of things where, I'll give you a really unsettling example, and apologies in advance, but just given the nature of the conversation. In the 9/11 attacks, there were these horrifying images of people throwing themselves from the burning towers. That is a very different action, morally, than someone just freely going to kill themselves. This was someone who realized they were about to die and leapt from a building. That seems to be the kind of thing where the church can say, that doesn't seem as grave. It seems like there are some real restrictions on your freedom when there's no way out of this alive. And you have psychologically overwhelming factors at hand. It's hard to imagine this was a deliberate and free choice in the way that we're talking about here. So then in paragraph 2283, we get kind of the flip side of the coin, which is that we should not despair of the eternal salvation of persons who've taken their own lives. By ways known to him alone, God can provide the opportunity for salutary repentance. The church prays for persons who've taken their own lives. For a long time, there was sort of a hasty assessment that the person was necessarily in hell. But I think as we've come to a greater understanding of psychology, frankly, we see that that may not be the case. And so we pray for them. We don't know what happens, but we know that God loves them even more than we love them, and we're grieved by their actions. So I don't know if that helps or not, but that would be kind of the framework I would kind of put in terms of how we would make sense of the question.
Charles?
Very clear. Thank you. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Absolutely. Pleasure.
And thanks for the call, and I hope you enjoyed our eclipse today.
Yes, the American eclipse.
Yes.
Well, America.
Freedom
and
eclipses.
Right?
We're just exporting all of our best
yes.
stuff.
Yes. Wait, what was that you said, Charles?
America is a continent.
Oh, that's an excellent point. Yes, that's an excellent point.
I think our neighbors to the south would even suggest two continents.
That's right. Yeah. We're just the Norte there. Part of that. Charles, thanks. Thanks for also being a good sport. The number is 888-318-7884. Going to Montana now. Silas is in Miles City, Montana, watching on YouTube. Silas, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, thanks, Si. I want to know, Joe, how you became an apologist and what you would recommend for me to become a better young apologist and advocate for the Catholic faith.
Brother, that's amazing. First of all, how old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 16.
You're starting out younger than I was, so you've got a leg up, you got a head start. I just say, donate to Catholic Answers every month. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, you can do that if you want to, but it won't automatically make you an apologist. I stumbled into being an apologist. I was a debater in high school and college, and then I had a Protestant roommate that I was very close to, and we were both debaters, and we would, you know, explore theology, and then we'd kind of talk shop about it. But then when I was in law school, I really did a much deeper dive in terms of reading the church fathers and finding out all this stuff I didn't realize growing up Catholic. And I was just on fire for it. And I was super, super annoying to all of my non-Catholic friends. And I knew I was, but I couldn't stop being obnoxious because I was really excited to talk about this. I needed somebody to talk about it with. And so in 2009, I started a Catholic blog just to have an outlet to talk about it. And so I'm not joking when I say, like, one of the ways to do this is just talk about the stuff you love about being Catholic. And I've moved through the world of apologetics kind of heart first, if that makes sense. Like, I rarely write about or speak about or research something I don't care about. I mean, occasionally it's like, oh, I should probably know more about XYZ sort of topic. But I usually just think, oh, I would like to know more about whatever. And then I go and read up on it. And then I want to talk about it with other people because I'm an extrovert to a fault. And then I, you know, turn it into an article or a podcast episode, or I just talk my wife's ear off about it or whatever that may be. And that is a really important kind of process. I mentioned this earlier in the last hour, but St. Thomas Aquinas has it's called a collatio, like a little post-mass talk that he gives on how Jesus grew in wisdom. And what he's really giving as well is the roadmap to how St. Thomas Aquinas became St. Thomas Aquinas. And it's called Puer Jesus, which just means child Jesus. So P-U-E-R, I think. I get the E and U mixed up all the time. P-U-E-R and then I-E-S-U-S. You can get it. I think the Thomistic Institute has it on their website. So there's much more that could be said, but I'd say learn to love the truth. And then as you do that, share it joyfully with others. And I think you're well on your way.
Silas, if you hang on the line during the break, we'll send you the Young Apologist Pack. I don't know what's in the Young Apologist Pack, but we'll think of something while we're on the break. Certainly Jimmy Akin's book, A Daily Defense. But right back with more Open Forum. This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns to the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. Join special guests Scott and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, and an all-star lineup of speakers September 26th through 29th. Spend time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and our special guests right here in beautiful San Diego. Seats are still available, but going fast. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 and register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Is Orthodoxy an alternative to the Catholic Church? In a time of uncertainty for many Catholics, Orthodoxy can look like greener pastures. Answering Orthodoxy, the new book from Catholic Answers Press, explains why Catholics who are thinking of leaving need to think twice. There are important reasons to remain in the Catholic Church and convincing answers to Orthodox claims. Order your copy of Answering Orthodoxy today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
There's truth in God's Word, and we can apply that to what's happening in our lives. I'm Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers, and I invite you to join me tomorrow for Beacon of Truth on most of these EWTN stations. Now back to Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. And guess what? There's a line open now. So if you've got a question, perfect time to call. We'll get you on before the top of the hour, 888-318-7884. Open Forum, by the way, is open to anyone. You don't have to be Catholic to call. If you got something that maybe you don't like about the Catholic faith you want to discuss with us, or maybe there's just something you don't understand or are curious about the Catholic faith, anyone can call, and we love these conversations. Joe just admitted to being excessively... What was it? Extroverted. So
excessively extroverted. Yeah,
and right. I do, because every now and then we get people say, oh, I didn't want to call because, you know, it's a Catholic show. And I didn't. No, we that's why we do the show. We want to talk with you about this stuff. 888-31.
I always tell people, like, you don't want to go to the doctor and be like, I'm fine. Like, no, this is the place to talk about whatever problems you have.
That's an excellent point. And my problem is just not going to the doctor. So
yeah, that's true. That's fair.
I think that's I don't know. My father's a doctor.
As long as you go to confession,
I go to confession. Yeah, I don't confess.
There you go.
I don't confess the not going to the doctor part. I never thought about that.
Oh no, I just meant like take better care of your soul than your body at least.
Oh, that's not even close. Good Lord, Joe. 888-318-7884 is the number. Molly in Buffalo, New York. Are all the calls now just coming from the, what's it called, the thing of totality? What's it called?
Zone of totality?
First of all, zone of totality. I don't know who came up with that, but boom, that's a great name. I want to live in the zone of totality.
They need to name other things.
Yeah, yeah. That person should be in charge of naming other stuff. Yeah. Molly in Buffalo, I don't know, were you guys in the zone of totality, Molly?
It got really dark. We had clouds, but it was like 10 o'clock at night. It was eerie. It was unbelievable. But we did have some clouds.
So oh, I'm sorry. So you didn't get to see the stars during the daytime, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but the way it got dark and it got cold, it was something to see. It was good.
Wow.
Yeah, it was an experience. And the way, because it happens like in 4 minutes, all of a sudden it happens so quick, how quick it gets. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, 1 minute you're looking, and all of a sudden you're like, "Oh my God, it's black as, you know, it's pitch black." So it was a sight to see, but we did have clouds. So part of it, we couldn't see some of it, but we did see some, you know, when it did get dark. So it was good. So I have a question for you. My sister had MS, and she had 14 lesions in her brain, and she had three kids and a husband with back injuries, and she was a computer scientist, the breadwinner of the family, and John couldn't do much because of his back. So she was taking the kids to hockey, and I mean, she had so much on her plate, it was unbelievable. Now, we have bipolar in the family. Now, I don't know if she was bipolar or not, or if it was the MS. But she started talking to God, and she was hospitalized, and she ended up going over Niagara Falls.
Oh, Molly, I'm sorry.
I know. So the body, once you go over Niagara Falls, the body, like, sits, the pressure brings you down into the water, so they don't find the body for about a month. So they found the body about a month later, and because of the way the body was, she had to be cremated. And my parents made the – now, we were all going to be buried. And my parents made the decision that once my sister was cremated, that they wanted to be cremated as well. So my uncle just passed away. So anyways, I'm doing my arrangements now. Just so they're done. My sister has, I have a niece and two nephews, but they have a new mother. My brother-in-law's remarried, and I just want all my pre-arrangements done so they don't have to worry about it. But the funeral director told me that Hillcrest is opening up where you can have three urns in a plot where I can be buried with my parents. But my heart of hearts, I don't want to be cremated. I want my body buried. So we found out that my grandparents, where my uncle, they're in a mausoleum. My uncle's with them. There's a fourth crypt. So my mom's the next of kin, and we're going to have it notarized, and I'm going to go into mausoleum. But like I was talking to Mike now, Mike said, if you change your mind, I mean, I don't know how I'm going to feel at 70. You know what I mean?
So, but I'm just what did you want Joe to help you with, Molly?
Well, I guess when did cremation come? I mean, because it used to be taboo. You know, I mean, I guess with Vatican II, and I talked to Jeanette from Woman of Grace, and she said that the church really wants you to be buried, but if there are circumstances that you can't afford it or whatever the circumstance is, then you have to be cremated, then you're cremated.
But so you want – wait, because Jeanette answered the question. I just want to know, is that – do you want to get Joe's opinion on it? Because I can tell you Joe is not going to give a better answer than Jeanette. That's not going to happen.
Hey,
so
that's probably right.
No, but is that what you were looking for, Molly, was for
– I was just looking to see see, now, because when I talk to Father David, he's like, oh, no, it's all good in the church. It could be cremated. But I just, I'd rather talk to a late, you know what I mean?
All right.
I really take Jeanette's opinion, well, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but all right, let's get from Joe the basic rundown on the status of cremation and how we got here.
Yes, so historically, the church has pushed pretty hard against cremation. Now, look, there were always cases where, based on how a person died, you didn't have their body available for a proper Christian burial. But Christian burial has always been an important part of the Christian faith, because unlike other religions, we had a very clear sense that you're not done with your body yet, because we believe in the resurrection of the body and the life of the world to come. And so even the sin we call sloth, Acadia or Acedia, the historic meaning of the word was like someone too lazy to bury the dead. And so there is a real sense that there's something just really incumbent upon us of caring for those who've died and have gone to their judgment. So in the book of Tobit, this is one of the signs that he's a holy man, is that he buries the dead. And so given all of this, we've historically been very much in favor of Christian burial and have given that as in many cases, the only acceptable option. There are cases in which it's now permitted. The CDF in 2016 highlighted sanitary, economic, or social considerations. Part of this is just the changing world. As I understand it right now, and I believe it's Singapore and in Germany, even if you elect to be buried, at a certain point, they will dig you up and cremate your body because they just are out of space. And so given those kind of changing realities, cremation may just be something you don't have a lot of control over. But nevertheless, the church is very clear. The CDF said in that same 2016 document that the choice for cremation must never violate the explicitly stated or reasonably inferable wishes of the deceased faithful. So if someone wants a Christian burial, you can't just override that and cremate them instead. And says, nevertheless, you know, cremation doesn't like stop your body from rising again on the last day. That's not the problem here. And in light of all of this, the church continues to prefer the practice of burying the bodies of the deceased because this shows a greater esteem toward the deceased. Nevertheless, cremation is not prohibited unless it was chosen for reasons contrary to Christian doctrine. So someone who says they want to be cremated because they're done with their body, no, that's a big no-go. That's not a Christian reason to choose cremation. But there may be a reason that a Christian believing in the resurrection of the body still views cremation as the best option given the particular cases. But it's not choice number one, and it's something that is the church has taken a pretty clear position of treating it not as a preferred option. It's something we want to discourage unless it makes a lot of sense in a particular case.
Molly, thank you. That brings us right to the break. I hope that answer was helpful to you. I think, I don't know. I think you probably gave Jeanette a run for her money. Joe, I'm guessing there that you probably did. I didn't.
If
hear
she's Jeanette. Listening, we'll let her call in. And
I know
tell
she
me
should
what
call it. Oh, Joe totally missed the all. The, okay. Molly, hang. No, I was going to say hang on, but you don't have to hang on because we're going to go to a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi friends, Jonet Williams here. Join me every Wednesday on Women of Grace Live as I welcome New Age researcher and blogger for Women of Grace, Sue Brinkman. Sue and I will be talking about all the wacky things that could distract you from your faith. Psychics, yoga, Reiki, crystals, acupuncture, Ouija boards, tarot cards, and astral traveling are just a few of the stranger things we discuss. That's why we call it Wacky Wednesday. So join us every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back to the Zone of Totality. No, excuse me. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I beg your pardon. But if we could work in that, could we do some kind of podcast? Catholic Answers Zone of Totality. That would be a good one.
I like it.
Yeah, I like it too. Let's go to Clint in Oklahoma, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Clint, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
All right. So I've been saving this question for Joe specifically because...
Oh boy!
Maybe he experienced this back in February as well. But my question
is this going to be Super Bowl related?
What? Yes.
It's a Super.
Oh, oh, sorry.
Don't bring up the Kansas City Chiefs when Joe is on. That's make all the rest of us miserable.
I've been waiting.
Okay. All right.
So, when would superstition become sinful? So if it's just, you know, the kind of you're watching the Super Bowl and you move to a different chair and all of a sudden the Chiefs have a great drive and now you don't want to move.
Did my dad tell you to call in with this question?
Is he football superstitious?
He's constantly asking things like this. Oh. I think he would tell you he's not superstitious, but he's a little stitious.
Little, yeah.
That is Edgar's. Edgar loves that joke. He does that joke all the time.
So, yeah, there's a lot wrong with superstition. So, I mean, a lot of that stuff I think is kind of jokey. And I'll tell you that the line between superstition and science is weirdly thinner than a lot of people realize it is. I'll give you an example. There are some things where they work and we don't know why they work. So let's say you got hiccups, right? And someone tells you to drink a glass of water, or my wife has this weird one where she puts a sheet of like a paper towel over like the lid of the water, and you drink the water through the paper towel. And I don't have any idea why this works, but it works 100% of the time in my limited experience. And I laughed at her until I had hiccups, and then it worked. And I was like, that seems more like witchcraft than it seems like science. But
oh, yeah.
There are things that, you know, they work and you don't know why they work. So superstition.
Like computers.
Is not. Yeah, that's fair. So think about the virtue of religion. Religion is man's desire to know God and kind of come in contact with God. That there's a weird excess in superstition where you're treating as religious things that aren't religious, like wearing your lucky socks on game day or something like this. It's become a quasi-religious ritual, and that is when it starts to become a problem. And so the Catechism in 2111 says this: superstition is the deviation of religious feeling and of the practices this feeling imposes. It can even affect the worship we offer the true God. E.g., when one attributes an importance in some way magical to certain practices otherwise lawful or necessary. Like if I say these prayers just right, then I'll get my thing that I'm wishing for or praying for. Then you're treating it not as prayer, but as some kind of like ritual that you can, and that starts to look much more like the occult. And so the Catechism says to attribute the efficacy of prayers or of sacramental signs to their mere external performance, apart from the interior dispositions that they demand, is to fall into superstition. So if you think about the way things like magical practices work, if you do these steps, then you'll achieve this outcome. And it's a way of harnessing like spiritual powers apart from reliance upon God. And that is a real spiritual danger. And paragraph 2138 even describes superstition as being manifested in idolatry, as well as in the various forms of divination and magic. So if you're trying to tap into divine power, and this may happen very explicitly, or maybe happen in a vaguer sort of way, that is not trusting in God or in his goodness. It's either not trusting in God because you think you can find some way around him, and that's ridiculous. Think about Jonah, trying to get away from God by getting on a boat. That's ridiculous. Or it's not trusting in the goodness of God, where you think you have to get the steps just right. And if you perform the ritual just perfectly, like a magical act, then God will do what you want. I think a lot of what we're calling superstition with sports, some of that is like that, where it is a misapplication of a religious principle. You start to actually assume a causality of your own actions. And some of it, I think, is maybe more playful. And even though we're calling it superstition, maybe wouldn't literally be. But I would just look at the spiritual mindset. The last thing I'd say isn't something the Catechism says, but I wonder if it wouldn't be applicable in this situation. If we're imagining our actions are the kind of causal agent of the game we're watching, it seems to me like one of the sins we may be struggling with there is pride, a sort of like narcissism that I'm kind of life's main character. And so therefore, you know, if I do everything just right, the Chiefs will win. And if I don't, then, well, they'll probably still win. But I don't know. Does that help at all?
Yeah, even better than I could have hoped for.
Oh,
oh, wonderful.
Very good. Don't walk under any
ladders. Call back after the win next year.
That is his real attitude too, Clint. It sounds like he's joking, but that's exactly, he means that. He means exactly what he just said. All right, let's go to Daniel in Las Vegas, Nevada, watching on YouTube. Daniel, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Joe.
Hi, hello. Yes, I'm a young, also Catholic apologist. I had a discussion with a non-denominational Christian last night around 2 a.m. And it was a question towards, he was making a point. I mean, he wasn't making a point. It was horrible. But he was saying that the modern Rome is different than the Rome that was, you know, from, you know, 2,000 years ago.
You mean the city, or
did
the,
he give
or,
any?
Oh, go ahead.
Examples.
Oh. He said that, you know, of course, man-made tradition and things like that, developing doctrine.
Oh, are you using Rome to mean the leadership of the Catholic Church? Is that what you mean when you say modern?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. So, all right. Yeah. All right. Joe?
Yeah. So I would actually push back a little bit even on the use of Rome there. I think as you're learning in kind of the world of Catholicism, there are certain Protestants who use Rome as a catch-all to mean the Roman Empire, the city of Rome, and the Roman Catholic Church, which are three very obviously distinct entities. But if you call it all Rome, then you can be like, well, Rome was responsible for killing Jesus, and now Rome is led by the Pope. And it's like, that's a real mix of a lot of confusion there, because, you know, the Pope isn't the president of Italy or even the mayor of the city of Rome. He's not Caesar over a Roman Empire that doesn't exist anymore. And so we need to make healthy distinctions. And so, yeah, I'd say in one sense, the Catholic Church looks very different even than 100 years ago. Technology, the growth of the church, all those things. The difference between a puppy and a dog, right? Like it's grown up now. And Jesus promised this in the parable of the mustard seed. He describes the church going from a mustard seed to a full-grown plant. In fact, the largest of the like shrubs. And so we should expect the church to go from being this very small movement to being the largest church on earth, which is exactly what we find in history. And so it gets more complicated. It gets more chaotic when you have a large church with over a billion people. In the same way that if you have a large party, you're going to have more chaos in your party. And if you have a large business, you might need more middle management and the rest. You know, when Apple Computers is in Steve Jobs' garage, I bet it looked pretty different than it looks today. But now it's grown up. So in that sense, there's plenty of changes we can talk about. But on the other hand, in terms of like the beliefs of the church, I would be happy to sit down with a non-denominational Christian and say, let's read for ourselves Christian writers from the 100s and the 200s and see whether I'm more comfortable with those writings or if you're more comfortable with those writings. Because many Protestants have a vague sense that the apostles and the early Christians must have believed what they believe, and then they don't really have any church history for the next 1500 years or so. And then they have kind of a story about the Reformation, and they kind of imagine the reformers believe the same things they do now, and that may or may not even be true. And so it turns out to be a very lightly sketched out church history that isn't really true. But when you go into church history, you realize people are saying these shockingly Catholic things from really early on. St. Irenaeus, the guy who tells us Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are the four Gospels, also tells us that Mary's the new Eve and that everyone has to listen to the Bishop of Rome because the Church of Rome is founded by Peter and Paul. And then he traces every pope from there. And you could go on and on and on with those kind of examples. The point being, the early Christians are very Catholic. And I've known of many people who've become Catholic upon reading the Church Fathers. And I've never, to my knowledge, encountered one person who was Catholic who left the Catholic Church because they started reading the early Christians. I literally don't know of one case. And it is maybe the leading cause I know of for people becoming Catholic. So I would just say, if this guy you're talking to believes that, then you should just say, great, let's both read the Church Fathers and we can find some together. In fact, if you stick around on the line, I will send you a copy of my book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. And it gives you a launching point where it focuses on a few issues. Jimmy Akin's book, The Fathers Know Best, is maybe even a better kind of compilation of
just give them both.
What did the Church Fathers. Yeah, okay, great. Yeah, both. And then from there, if you want to go pull up those documents and just read them all for yourselves, they're readily available online. We live in this incredible digital age where all that information is available for free at your fingertips. And so people just can't get away with saying the early Christians believed what a non-denominational Christian does because they just didn't.
Okay, Daniel?
I mean, yes, something very quick. Yeah, it was a very strange discussion with him. He was not allowing me to bring in history. It was very difficult to talk to him. Of course, he was muting me, and even at the end of the discussion, when I was criticizing his disrespect towards me, he kicked me out of the video call. So, yep.
That seems like a reasonable Christian approach. I'm just kidding. So I would just say that is something that you should be aware of. Like history is on our side, and so one side of the Catholic Protestant thing is constantly saying, read the early church. And you find a lot of people on the other side saying, no, don't read history, just read the Bible alone. That should tell you which side history is on. And so the person saying that can't also then make a historical claim about how the early Christians agreed with them, because you just said we couldn't read history to find out if you're lying. That's a big red flag. If you're making historical claims and telling me not to find out if you're telling the truth, I've got some trust issues here.
Yeah, I would say the burden of proof shifts at that point where you say, well, you'd have to show me what you mean because my understanding of history is different, and then let the other person explain it if they want. Daniel, we're going to send you those books. The Early Church Was the Catholic Church and The Fathers Know Best. If you hang on, we'll get that to you. I want to get to Robert in Vancouver, Washington, watching on YouTube. Robert, if you could be kind of quick with the question, it'll give Joe a minute to answer.
I'll ask a different, faster question. Speaking of the Church Fathers, someone said Polycarp was not a Catholic bishop. He was actually three fish in a trench coat. Agree? Disagree?
Polycarp. Get it? Polycarp.
Oh, wow. You got that one faster. Carpe diem. You grabbed that.
Is that red? Now, what were you going to ask, Robert?
I was going to ask, how can we defend that the early Church Fathers actually were Catholic bishops?
Yeah, like maybe Ignatius and Polycarp.
Yes. Ignatius of Antioch in about 107 writes about this. And he is very explicitly says, you don't have a church unless you have the trifold ministry, bishop, priest, deacon, or bishop, presbyter, deacon is the language he used at the time. And so the idea of what's called monoepiscopacy, there's one bishop per church, is very easily attested from the students of the apostles. And we don't find any dissent to that view, which is shocking. We don't find anyone saying, no, you can have a ruling body of presbyters. You know, you'll find Protestants who imagine that the early church had like a co-ruling body of presbyters. And we literally don't have any examples of that. We have hundreds of examples in the early church of being able to point to who the bishop was in a locality and no examples of the opposite. So it's like trying to prove that rain is wet. It's the evidence is very much on your side on this. If you stick around, if we can give you a copy of my book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. There's a whole chapter in there just on that question.
And we always welcome a good Polycarp joke. anytime anyone wants to bring a good Polycarp joke. Thank you, Robert. Sorry to those we didn't get to, but we'll do it again tomorrow. Can we do open forum tomorrow again? All right, we'll do open forum again. Can we have Tim Staples come in? All right, we'll do open forum tomorrow with Tim Staples. So give us a call then. Joe Heschmeyer has been our guest. You really should check out his work at Shameless Popery. You can go to shamelessjoe.com. Or you can just put in your machine, Shameless Popery, and find him on YouTube. Joe, thanks very much. I'm glad you survived the eclipse and were able to do the show with us today.
It's my pleasure.
All right. I'm heading home to my own little zone of totality. I'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.